13-19-365-CB, Victor H. Sanchez, NSM3 Investments Limited versus Doctors Hospital at Renaissance Limited and RTV Med LLC. Who is arguing for the appellant?
My name is Robert Chaykin. I'm here for the appellants.
And how much time would you like to use, Mr. Chaykin?
I'd like to
split it.
What do I have, 15 total, Your Honor?
20 total.
20 total, so 15 and then 5, please.
Okay. And who will be arguing for appellee?
Ricardo Pomarojo here on behalf of the appellees. I'll reserve on my 20 minutes, but I'll be yielding back whatever time I use.
Okay, we appreciate that. All right, then we can proceed, and we'll go ahead and begin, Mr. Chaykin.
Good morning, Justices. Thank you. And I think I probably will be yielding some time back as well. I'll assume that you all have already had an opportunity to read this record and have some understanding of what is.
Yes. Don't need to go over the facts or any of that. We've read all of that.
Excellent. And with that being said, this is obviously an appeal that arises out of an arbitration award. That award was subject to a challenge in the trial court. The appellants had moved to have the trial court vacate the arbitration award or reverse it. The trial court did not do so. Instead, the trial court had entered confirming the arbitration award. So this case is one that obviously involves an important principle in Texas law, which is the challenge to these arbitration awards and the scope and nature of what kind of a challenge will be allowed and under what circumstance. In this case, it's notable for a couple of reasons. The arbitration provision itself, so this is a dispute over a partnership agreement and the termination of a partnership interest, obviously. The agreement between the parties, the actual partnership agreement itself, provided that it would be governed by Texas law and choice of law provisions. Inside of the partnership agreement, in and of itself, there is an arbitration provision. And the language of that provision is set out, obviously, in the briefs. It's easily found in the record. I've got cites at either the record at 194 or 244 if you all need to locate the actual provision. The provision contains some language that we contend limits the scope and bears on the scope and efforts of the arbitrators. Namely, number one is that the agreement, the provision for arbitration, requires that the arbitrators apply Texas law, Texas custom, and Texas usage. The provision also provides that the arbitrators explain and set forth the basis and the rationale for their findings. There's also a provision in there that addresses the use of the federal rules of evidence. I don't know that that's necessarily an issue on appeal today, but it does illustrate that these parties had a provision that was specific in some ways and was tailored for purposes of their use. This is a partnership agreement that was drafted by the defendants. And the contention here on the appellant's part is that these provisions had meaning separate and apart from the regular partnership agreement. And that it was important that the arbitrators apply Texas law and then explain how they did so in their award. And the reasons for that is because, and at least the contention here is that it would provide a mechanism for an appellate review and to determine whether or not reversible error was committed by the panel. In this case, the arbitrators found a breach of the partnership agreement. They determined that Mr. Sanchez's partnership interests was wrongfully terminated. That the residency requirement that was being utilized in the partnership agreement for such purpose was not valid. And if the page 8 of our brief details all of the findings of the arbitrator's findings on that point.
But before we get there, we have to first determine that we can even look at this, that you have actually agreed to an expanded review as the parties did in the NAFTA case. Is that right? The NAFTA traders? And you have sent the case, Belfior, hopefully that's the correct pronunciation, and you've cited it saying that the arbitration provision in that contract was virtually identical to the one in this case. Of course, that's not a published opinion, but even if we were to accept it, the court in that case said that they assumed without deciding that the language was an agreement to limit the panel's power to that of a judge. So the court didn't really decide that that language was there. And Appellee has cited a number of cases saying that the type of language that you're referring to has not been found to be enough to expand it to judicial review. So how do you respond to that?
And I appreciate the question. I was going to get to the case law next, but Justice, one way or the other, we got to get there. I agree. And so the NAFTA case is, you know, the Texas Supreme Court coming out after the Hall case at the United States Supreme Court and reaching out and trying to provide some guidance on what can or cannot be argued on appeal from these arbitrations. And the NAFTA traders case, you know, notably finds that there is some basis to review and challenge and that the parties by contract under the Texas Arbitration Act, as opposed to the Federal Arbitration Act, can in fact contractually discuss and try and limit and address the scope of powers of the arbitrator. Notably in the NAFTA traders agreement, there was language that specifically said, among other things, reversible error. So they used
very clear.
they used some magic language when they said that. And there are a lot of other cases. I don't know that the Texas Supreme Court has actually spoken again on the exact issue or the exact language, but the Belfiore case was interesting, obviously, for the appellants. And I agree. They essentially said we're going to assume that this contractual provision, an almost identical language, with the exception of the part about the explanation and the rationale for the award. So the Belfiore agreement talked about applying Texas law and those types of things. But when the court did in fact say they just assumed something and said, but we're not gonna get there and actually pass on it and make that a holding one way or the other. And instead, what the court did is it went and said, we looked at the actual evidence and the sufficiency of the record and determined that the finding of liquidated damages in that case was not a violation or, you know, an aberration of Texas law. And so they upheld in the award. And I didn't mean to represent in my briefing, and if I did, that there was a holding in Belfiore that found that this language specifically held that the language was acceptable or sufficient to kick or trigger the ability to review one of these arbitrations. What I would say to you is that, again, in this context, in this case, with this language, you have some external factors in terms of the nature of the actual partnership agreement that addresses Texas law, and then the fact that it appears again in the more specific area of the scope of the arbitrator's powers. It's there for a reason. It wouldn't be superfluous and it shouldn't be rendered meaningless, particularly where these defendants drafted this partnership agreement. They wanted it there and they wanted to make sure that these arbitrators complied with and enforced Texas law and wanted the additional requirement that they actually explain and set forth the basis for the rationale. And that's where the breakdown is in this case, because they clearly find a breach on a number of different fronts. They actually pass muster on the credibility of, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I'm leaning forward, I'm checking my time. They pass muster on the sufficiency and credibility of some of these witnesses and things of that nature. The breakdown here is that this panel, after finding a breach and clearly finding one, they basically make a statement that it's not outcome determinative And then they never really provide the rationale as to why. And they certainly don't enunciate principles of Texas law, be it any of the affirmative defenses that were asserted by the appellees in this case. Clearly, they don't indicate that this repurchase assignment was a release, for example, or functioned as a legal release as a matter of law. And so all of these issues were ignored by the arbitration panel. And under the contractual provisions here of this arbitration clause, they were required to follow Texas law, which they didn't do, is the contention, and then explain what the rationale was anyhow. And the reason for that is so that if they had explained it and had set forth legal reasoning, then this could have been reviewed on appeal. And I believe that's the purpose. And that's why you have that combined language in this provision. The other interesting thing about the
NAFTA. Before you leave that, how are we getting beyond the restricted review that normally arbitration agreements provide? In your brief, you've argued that the rulings exceed the scope of Texas law, but based on your arguments, you merely appear to be arguing that they incorrectly applied
Texas law. I think there are two considerations, and that is that if there is no provision in an arbitration clause that addresses the scope of powers or what law they are to apply or how they're supposed to review a case, then they have there's a default mechanism under the TAA, and they have pretty much free rein. If in fact the parties contract and want an actual review process or a determination to be made under Texas law, and then an explanation for same, we believe that actually triggers the appellate review and makes it more than just a restricted review, and actually makes it a de novo review of the actual rulings of law in this case and the underlying evidence. And the NAFTA court, the NAFTA court addressed this in terms of saying if you get to the point where you're beyond the restricted appeal and review, then it's a function of what is the evidence or what is the record delineate or evidence. And the NAFTA, to anticipate one of the arguments that the appellees are making, I think they had alleged that the lack of a formal, complete, certified official transcript of the underlying proceeding would prevent that review. And I don't believe NAFTA goes that far. In fact, I think what NAFTA really says is you just have to have enough evidence for the appellate court on a de novo basis to review sufficiency. And this record, I believe, has all of that evidence. I believe the award itself on its face is facially violative of the party's contractual agreement, because the arbitrators never did explain with any real sufficiency how it was that they could find and award no damages. One other item.
Appellee has also, with regard to the record, the appellee, as you know, has argued that the record that you have supplied is not an official record, and that therefore not sufficient for us to review, even if we get past the ability to look at it.
Correct. I don't think NAFTA requires an official record, and I could cite you to the portions of NAFTA in our brief where we discuss that. But I don't think, as long as there's enough reliable and sufficient evidence in the record, I don't believe it has to be an official reporter's transcript. The only other issue that I neglected to address here is that one other failure in this case is that these arbitrators also exceeded the scope, because in determining and awarding attorney's fees and finding DHR a prevailing party, they didn't engage in any segregation of fees in this case. And so they found that both Mr. Sanchez individually and the entity were jointly and severally liable for attorney's fees. And that also was in contravention of Texas law. And frankly, under the facts of this case, they determined that Mr. Sanchez individually never had any standing to pursue the claims. They were all held beneficially by his entity. And so that in and of itself is an important mistake here, and an important contravention of Texas law, because they are finding that Mr. Sanchez is jointly and severally liable for a large attorney's fees award. And they don't explain the basis for doing that either in this award, and that finding is also in contravention of Texas law. Those fees needed to be allocated and segregated and demonstrably shown to apply to to Mr. Sanchez.
But Appley has argued that that's something that should have been raised early on in the process, because Mr. Sanchez is actually the one that initiated this whole proceeding. And yet now he wants to say, well, I shouldn't get any of the fees because I don't have standing.
Well, to address that, Justice, Mr. Sanchez and the entity both were plaintiffs. The issue was raised in the underlying arbitration that he had no standing, but without the determination of that question, then he was going to be in the case. But the fees that were spent on the case were going to have to be spent to defend the entity one way or the other. It's simply a question of what did they actually spend independently to determine and show that he had no standing to begin with. And that there is some number for that. They just never broke it out and never put it into evidence at the arbitration or anywhere else for that matter. But again, in other words, they found he had no standing under the agreement. They had found he had no standing to sue, yet they made him jointly and severally liable for all of the attorney's fees that were spent in this case. And so I think I have, well, I'm out of time and I apologize. Just when you think you wouldn't use it all, maybe I won't use all that 5 minutes. Again, I apologize. Thank you.
Sorry, I muted myself because they were banging really loud next door. So that's fine. You will, of course, have your 5 minutes. And if you need them, you use them. All right, Mr. Guanejo.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The appellants are asking the court to do a great deal of historical groundbreaking in this appeal. The court should note that in the 23 plus years that the Texas Arbitration Act, the TAA, has existed,
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you, Mr. Buenvedejo. Are you all, can you all hear him well? Is it just on my end or?
I can hear you. Low.
It's kind of low. Is it?
Yes.
Can you hear me okay right now?
I can.
Yeah, just speak loudly, please. Thank you.
The court should note that in the 23 plus years that the Texas Arbitration Act has existed, this court has never held that an arbitration award be vacated under it. Also, in the 9+ years following the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in Aptitraders, no Texas appellate court has since come across an arbitration clause that evidences a clear agreement to limit an arbitrator's authority and to expand the scope of judicial review. And lastly, no Texas appellate court has ever vacated an arbitration award under an expanded judicial review. Given the historical groundbreaking that appellants are seeking to make here, the court has to ask itself what makes this appeal and the arbitration agreement at issue so special. The short answer is nothing, but there are four reasons as to why that's the case, and I would like to try to discuss all those reasons today in the following order. First, the arbitration clauses do not evidence a clear agreement to provide for an expanded judicial review of any award. Second, there is no official transcript of the arbitration hearing, which means that the court lacks a sufficient record through which it can engage in an expanded judicial review. Third, nearly all hearing exhibits are missing from the appellate record, and the court must presume that those missing exhibits support the arbitration panel's findings. And fourth, there simply is no reversible error to be found in this record. Now, Appley's first argument is that the arbitration clause at issue here does not evidence a clear agreement to one, limit an arbitrator's authority, and two, expand the scope of judicial review. As recognized in Aptitraders, that is the type of agreement that must exist here for there to be an expanded judicial review of an arbitration award. Aptitraders concerned an arbitration clause that contained the following language, quote, the arbitrator does not have authority to render a decision which contains a reversible error of state or federal law. The reference to reversible error was viewed in Aptitraders as a clear reference to the type of review that is undertaken when one reviews judicial decisions. And so while prohibiting the arbitrator from making decisions based on reversible error. The agreement expanded the scope of judicial review in NAFTA traders by allowing the arbitrator's decision to be reviewed the same way a judicial decision is reviewed. The key language found in NAFTA traders does not exist here. The phrase, the arbitrator does not have authority, does not exist in this case, nor does anything close to that language exist here. The arbitration clause also does not contain the term reversible error. And so in the absence of this language, appellants are relying on one, the choice of law provision that requires the application of Texas law, and two, the provision that requires the arbitration panel to set forth their findings and conclusions in any award. But these sorts of provisions do not evidence a clear agreement to limit an arbitrator's authority and to expand the scope of judicial review.
Mr. Pumatem, I know you have cited a number of cases in your brief and have not read all of them, I'll confess. Is there one that is on point with this language that we have in this case that where the court has said that did not expand judicial review? A Texas case.
Yes. I cite in the brief, we cite seven cases from four different courts of appeals that have all recognized that a provision that simply states that Texas law should be applied is not enough. Maybe about three of those seven opinions, the arbitration clause at issue, the language that requires the application of Texas law is not provided. I did attempt to look for it through looking through online filings, and in some cases was able to find it. But even those cases, though, generally contain a statement that encompasses this case. They contain a statement that simply says, recognizes that a statement that generally requires the application of Texas law is not sufficient. By way of examples, if in Medani versus Smith, that's a Ninth Court of Appeals opinion, that's on page 37, the arbitration clause there said, the arbitrator's decision shall be based on evidence submitted and governed by the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, Texas Rules of Evidence, and statutory and case law. I think that is akin to what we're dealing with here. It's this general calling upon the arbitrators to apply Texas law.
And what about the other concern that they have, the failure to set forth, I think you've argued that you feel that the arbitrator did set forth their findings and conclusions adequately.
That is a completely separate issue from whether or not the award needs to be vacated. Arguing that enough detail has not been provided does not reflect that there is something that is that the award is predicated on reversible error and should be vacated. Our position that we take in the brief is that the argument that not enough detail has been provided in the award has been waived. It's been waived at the trial court level, because at no time was the trial court asked to remand back to the arbitration panel so that they could provide the detail that the appellants feel is lacking here. And it's also been waived before this court, because there is no request before this court to remand to the arbitration panel so that more detail can be provided. But ultimately, it is our position that the issue has been waived, but that even if it wasn't waived, there is more than sufficient detail here. I know that counsel has stated that he sees no explanation as to why the repurchase assignment moots any kind of breach of contract in relation to the DHR agreement and the RGV regulations. But the fact is, if you look at the award, it contains over two pages of single-spaced text explaining why the repurchase assignment moots any kind of breach that the appellees may have committed. There is no problem with the lack of analysis in the award. This is just an issue that appellants do not like the analysis that's there. I mean, truth be told, the award actually suffers from too much analysis. It could have been very easy for the arbitration panel to simply write a short award stating, you know, any breach of the DHR agreement and the RGB regulations is a moot point because the parties later entered into a superseding agreement that made any kind of prior breach a moot point. And they could have stopped there, but they didn't. I mean, they essentially provided what a court would call dicta and gave it more reasons and more analysis than what they were really required to give. Back to on the NAFTA traders, all these courts have determined that a provision directing an arbitrator to apply Texas law is far different from a provision that clearly deprives the arbitrator of the power to make any error in the application of Texas law. Appellate courts have also observed that a choice of law clause directing an arbitrator to apply Texas law often does not change how an arbitrator would have to proceed in the absence of such a clause. And that's because in the absence of a choice of law clause, an arbitrator, much like a court would have to do, would be expected to apply the substantive law of the state with the most significant relationship to the particular dispute at issue. And in this case, Texas was the only state that arguably had a significant relationship with the dispute between the appellants and the appellees. Therefore, even in the absence of any kind of choice of law clause, the arbitration panel would have been fully expected to apply Texas law. The other arbitration provision on which appellants rely as evidence of some kind of agreement for expanded judicial review is a provision that merely calls on the arbitration panel to issue a reasoned award, but a provision that merely directs the manner in which an award must be drafted does nothing to evidence a clear agreement to limit an arbitrator's authority and expand the scope of judicial review. The 14th Court of Appeals expressly recognized as much in Denbury Offshore LLC versus Texcal Energy, which is on page 41 of Appley's brief. Furthermore, a provision requiring the arbitration panel to set forth its findings and conclusions this award did not call on the panel to do anything that it could have already been required to do under Rule R46 of the AAA Commercial Rules. Under Rule R46, an arbitrator must render a reasoned award if a party requests such an award prior to the arbitrator's appointment. If a choice of law provision and a provision requiring the issuance of a reasoned award were sufficient to satisfy the clear agreement standard articulated in NAFTA traders, then nearly every arbitration award would be subject to an expanded judicial review. And that's because the sort of provisions that appellants are relying on here are commonplace in nearly all arbitration agreements. Moreover, there is an important arbitration provision that appellants are ignoring on appeal. And that provision reads as follows. It states that any award pursuant to such arbitration shall be final and binding upon the parties. This is language that was not found in NAFTA traders. Also, the 9th Court of Appeals in Preston versus Dyer has held that such language speaks against a determination that the parties have agreed to an expanded judicial review. So for all of these reasons, the court should hold that the arbitration agreements at issue here do not allow for an expanded judicial review. But now, even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that expanded judicial review was clearly agreed to in this case, appellants would still not be entitled to relief because there is not a sufficient record of the arbitration proceedings. And that brings me to my second argument. In NAFTA traders, the Supreme Court stated the following: an arbitration award is not susceptible to full judicial review merely because the parties have agreed. A court must have a sufficient record of the arbitral proceedings and complaints must have been preserved, all as if the award were a court judgment on appeal.
You said the language they used was a sufficient record, but you have used official record, and you're basing that on
correct,
just as if it were on an appeal.
Yes, and let me get to that. Under Rule R28C, of the AAA commercial rules. An official record can only exist if, one, the parties mutually agree that a transcript or other recording will serve as an official record, or two, the arbitrator decides that a transcript or other recording will serve as an official record. There's no evidence here that in the appellate record that the parties agreed to have the transcripts constitute an official record. And there's also no evidence that the arbitration panel decided that the transcripts would serve as an official record. In fact, the appellate record makes clear that there is no official record, because on the first page of the arbitration award, the arbitration panel wrote the following: although a court reporter was present at the hearing, no official transcript of the final hearing has been designated. In the absence of an official record, it's impossible for the court to engage in any expanded judicial review in NAFTA traders, in any kind of expanded judicial review. And Justice Contreras, I'm now going to your point, to your question. In NAFTA traders, the Supreme Court stated the following, and this is key language: in appeals from judicial proceedings, the requirements for preserving complaints and for the record are set out respectively in Rules 33-34, the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. Although these rules are not written for appeals from arbitration awards, their principles should govern such appeals. And so Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 34 recognizes that a reviewing court must conduct its review through an official record, a designation that could come from only a court clerk, a court reporter, and or written stipulation of the parties reflecting an agreement as to what shall constitute an official record. And in this case, the court has received no hearing exhibit or transcript that has been certified, designated, or stipulated as an official record by the panel, by a AAA custodian of records, or by party agreement. Therefore, in accordance with NAFTA traders, this court must find that it has no proper record before it through which the arbitration award can be reviewed for reversible error. Now, even if the court believed that there was a clear agreement to permit expanded judicial review, and even if the court believed the unofficial record before it could be utilized to conduct an expanded judicial review, appellants would still not be entitled to relief. And that is because there are more than 100 arbitration hearing exhibits that are not in the appellate record. There were approximately 132 exhibits introduced at the four-day arbitration hearing. And these exhibits were not provided to the trial court and are thus not before this court. And this is significant because this court has repeatedly recognized that it has an obligation to presume that any evidence not included in the appellate record is sufficient to support the trial court's decision. And if an arbitration award in this, if the arbitration award in this case is to be reviewed the same way a trial court's decision is reviewed, then this court must similarly presume that the 132 exhibits missing from the record support all of the arbitration panel's findings. Lastly, if the court was to reject all the arguments that have made so far and was thus committed to assessing whether the arbitration award is predicated on reversible error, appellants would still not be entitled to relief. And that's because there's simply no reversible error here. First, appellants argue that error exists because the panel found that appellees breached the DHR agreement and RGV regulations, but nonetheless did not award appellants any damages for that breach. Specifically, the panel found that appellees did not have the right to seek a forced repurchase of SM3's units. And I want to emphasize the word seek because there was ultimately no forced repurchase. The panel explained in its award that any breach of the DHR agreement and the RGV regulations was rendered a moot point by appellants because they voluntarily executed the repurchase assignment, which constituted a subsequent enforceable agreement between the parties. The repurchase assignment superseded the DHR agreement and the RGV regulations. And because the panel found no meritorious basis for setting aside the repurchase assignment, the panel correctly determined that appellants could not recover damages in connection with any breach of what continue to be superseded agreements, namely the DHR agreement and the RGB regulations. Second, appellants argue that Sanchez should not have been found jointly and severally liable with SM3 for Appley's attorney's fees because the panel found that Sanchez lacked standing to seek that the relief that he sought. But this argument fails. To begin, Appley's have never taken the position that Sanchez did not have standing to invoke the arbitration clauses found in the DHR agreement and the RGB regulations. In fact, Appley's have previously asserted that Sanchez should have invoked the arbitration clauses if, one, he truly believed he was not in violation of the residency requirements, and two, he was truly opposed to appellant's repurchase of the SM3 units. But Sanchez did not do that. Instead, he waited until after the DHR agreement and the RGB regulations had been superseded by the repurchase assignment to invoke the arbitration clauses. And when he did invoke those clauses, he did so for the sole purpose of seeking relief that only SM3 had standing to pursue. Namely, he sought damages in his individual capacity in connection with the repurchase of SM3's units. And that was relief that he did not have standing to seek. The arbitration clauses entitle the prevailing party to recover their fees. And the reason for why a party ultimately prevails is irrelevant to whether a fee recovery is allowed. Accordingly, there is no inconsistency in the panel's determination that Sanchez lacks standing to pursue the relief he sought, and the panel's determination that Sanchez is jointly and severally liable with SM3 for Appley's attorney's fees. I believe that I've now covered all that I wanted to address here today. So unless the court has any questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time and conclude by stating that for all the reasons explained in Appley's brief in this oral argument, this appeal does not merit any historical groundbreaking here. The trial court properly issued an order confirming the arbitration award and denying appellant's motion to vacate, and that order should be affirmed by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Bumanejo. Mr. Chaykin, you're muted, sir.
After 9 months of this and about three of these arguments on appeal, you'd think by now I'd remember to click the mute. My apologies. I'm sure whatever it was I was just about to say probably was not earth-shattering.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Kathy, that should be 5 minutes. It's rebuttal. There we go. Okay.
Very quickly, the issue here, and I think there was some mixing and matching and some editorializing here by Appley's counsel, but the bottom line is the provisions at issue in this case state that the panel shall apply Texas law and then internal customs and usage, and they shall also set forth the rationale and the reasoning for that. And that's important because I think the purpose of that ostensibly was to provide a mechanism and a basis to have an appellate review. And I what I heard was actually when he was queried on if there was any cases that were directly on point, there's really not. There's some cases that speak to a portion of some of these provisions with regard to applying the Texas law. There are some that maybe talk about setting forth the reasoning, and then Mr. Pumajero had to direct your attention to the rules of the AAA. I think when you look at this in totality, there was a failure here, and it was a failure because they did exceed their scope because they didn't comply with the provisions, and it was a material failure. And the point of the language about explaining the award is that it elucidates and illustrates the need for them to, in fact, comply with Texas law, which they didn't. Now, I agree. The majority of these cases.
Well, as Mr. Justice Perks pointed out earlier, they did apply Texas law. Your position is they just applied it incorrectly.
Well, they didn't apply it completely because they only, in fairness, they only applied it to evaluating the breach, and then they kind of stopped the analysis or the application of Texas law.
Okay, so your argument is that they didn't apply it completely for all of the claims. Okay.
Exactly. For the entirety of the award, including the decision on attorney's fees. Okay. And that's important. This court has an ability to review this record and the award. You could review this award on its face and find that it's facially violative of the arbitration provisions without even getting to the record. But again, and it's our position, NAFTA does not require an official court reporter's record. Instead, what NAFTA speaks to is a sufficient record and a record that allows for this panel to engage in an evidentiary analysis to review this case de novo and then vacate the award. And it doesn't
elaborate a little bit on how you get around the subsequent agreement not mooting the prior agreement where breaches were found.
Yes, and that's one of the turn points here of this case. That agreement was an agreement that the evidence demonstrated was irrelevant to the transaction because DHR was going to force this repurchase whether or not Mr. Sanchez signed an assignment or not. The execution of that assignment was merely to allow for an accounting transaction to occur. That assignment notably doesn't contain any type of a release of claims or limitation on his ability to sue for his actual damages. And that's been an argument in this case from day one. These folks had argued a series of affirmative defenses in this case, none of which were addressed or encapsulated in this award to explain how it was that the execution of this assignment would actually negate the breach or mute the breach. At best, what the assignment revealed was that Mr. Sanchez did receive a sum of money, which all along was going to be an offset or credit against any damages which were awarded. But the panel, the arbitration panel, and by extension the trial court, never engaged in that review of that analysis. But that assignment is not outcome determinative, just as a matter of evidentiary argument. But they certainly don't explain how and under what theory or legal theory that would be the case. And so with that, I will yield my time. I just would like to say, one last thing, which is that at some point there's got to be a case that starts to break the mold here. So, the fact that a lot of other cases that may or may not even be binding on this court or may involve Federal Arbitration Act law shouldn't compel an automatic denial here. This is a case that warrants a vacature and a rendering or a reversal for further proceedings. And I appreciate the time and the questions. Thank you.
You say break the mold in the case that we just heard right before yours. We'd have to do the same thing. These things come up. But thank you very much for your arguments. And the case will be under submission. Appreciate you being here today. Y'all stay safe and healthy out
there. Thank you.
All right.
You.